What would you do if you were hospitalized far from home? Don't worry, AirMed Care Network has you covered with FlyU Home memberships. Just one call and their providers will transport you back to a hospital of your choice to recover closer to loved ones at zero out-of-pocket cost to you. FlyU Home offers coast-to-coast and worldwide coverage and is remarkably affordable, starting at $159 a year. Learn more at airmedcarenetwork.com/fly.
It's time to win. Yamava Resort and Casino at San Manuel is giving away a Richard Mille watch, plus $15,000 cash. Secure a finalist spot with three ways to play in March and April for your chance to win. It all builds up to the grand finale on April 9th, when one lucky Club Serrano member takes home the coveted luxury Swiss timepiece. Join for free today for your chance to win at Yamava Resort and Casino, the only AAA 5-diamond rated casino hotel in the country. Details at yamava.com. Must be 21 to enter. Please gamble responsibly.
Well, it's being converted on the fly, so every moment that it's in use, it's being converted. It's like 1984. It's a relentless totalitarian conversion that never stops. You want to imagine the future? Imagine a USB 2 cable into a USB 3 cable, stamping on a human face forever.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Stephen Hayward and Charles C.W. Cook. I'm James Lilacs, and today we talk to Jerry Baker, editor-in-large of the Wall Street Journal. So let's have ourselves a podcast.
Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. That members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Ricochet Podcast number 731. I'm James Lilacs in Minneapolis. Beautiful, crisp day. We got about 10 inches of snow. Yeah, we can take it. It's March. I'm joined by Stephen Hayward and Charles C.W. Cook, who are, I believe, in respective polls of the country, Florida and California. And where to start with this week? Every day, it seems to be something, and then we forget that we... did we annex Greenland last week? I don't know. A swirling constellation of stars around your head like somebody in a cartoon who's been whacked on the noggin with a frying pan. So where to begin? What do you guys, what stands out at the end of this contentious week as the most important issue to you, or the one perhaps that flew under the radar that will be something we're talking about in a little bit now? Could it be the Supreme Court decision that appeared to slam the knuckles of Doge, Stephen? Charlie?
Well, I'm not quite sure it did that. It's a little bit obscure and maybe technical and narrow. I think actually the biggest story of the week is still unfolding today, Friday, as we're talking. First, 2 days ago, we had the news that Gavin Newsom is now a podcaster. By the way, I predict he's going to do as well at podcasting as Mario Cuomo did at talk radio 30 years ago. And everyone thought he'd be the rival for Rush, and he was just boring as could be. But what the news was that Newsom suddenly sounded like a Republican centrist. I'm against boys and women's sports. I don't want to use Latinx. Defunding the police was idiotic. So this is clearly someone gearing up to run for president. But then it's followed up by the news that after Senate Democrats voted unanimously to block the Republican bill to ban trans women from women's sports, suddenly they're changing their tune. And now they're out with a new proposal. Well, let's let the states decide, you know, sort of their equivalent of the Dobbs decision on abortion, I suppose you might say. And I think you're seeing the weakening here on some of these cultural issues on the left because they realize they're getting killed on this. And so anyway, I think that's the sleeper story that's going to grow, and it's going to cause great divisions inside the Democratic coalition.
Interesting. Well, yes, watching Newsom molt and shed his skin is interesting. But then there are some people who say, well, I'm looking at this bill here. They're talking about boys and women's sports. I don't like it. But on the other hand, I looked at my IRA the other day, too, and I really don't like that.
Yeah. And it seems to be getting worse. If you look at the stock market right now, it's worse than it was this morning. And that in turn is worse than it was yesterday. It was okay 12 days ago. It seems to me, James, and I don't know if you think this is maybe a conspiracy theory or me putting pieces together that don't belong, but do you think this might have to do with the tariffs?
I think it might.
Yeah?
And, you know, as somebody who is on the cusp of retirement and, you know, I generally don't check those things. They go up, they go down, you know, whatever. We, you know, I don't like it. And I especially don't like it because it seems to be what we call an unforced error, our own goal. I was not in the mood particularly for a trade war with Canada. And while Canada may indeed have onerous tariffs on American milk, it's just it's not really up there. Now, I understand the long-term reasoning is to do this, to bring back manufacturing to the country, and we have to go through short-term pain, and then in 5 years it'll all be better because we'll have more industries and businesses here. One of the major car companies announced that they're going to start building some stuff in America. Again, I get that. I get that. But I hate tariffs. I just do. I just do. And maybe it's because I associate them, you know, with Smoot and or Hawley and think that didn't work. And maybe this doesn't work now. So, the Mexican tariffs have been abated for a month, though, have they not? Did they not decide to step away from those for a while?
Well, they're Schrodinger's tariffs, you see. And they're introduced. Well, because they right. both exist and don't exist, and they're both good and bad. Because when they're introduced, there's all these reasons that we need them. We need to be more like America in the 1890s when we were apparently rich. We need to be like William McKinley. We need to protect industry and create jobs and potentially even get rid of the income tax. And that's just terrific. And that's why tariffs are so good. And it's the most beautiful word in the English language. And we all love them. Also, they're so horrible that if you threaten people with them, then you get things that you want. So we don't really want tariffs. What we want is to threaten tariffs and then not do them, because obviously we wouldn't do tariffs. Trump actually did this yesterday, James. He actually said yesterday, when he was announcing that he might give some tariff relief, that he was going to rescind some of the tariffs to protect American industries from them. But you put them on. So he's both the provider and the taker.
Yeah, I mean, I think the embarrassing irony here is that if you go back to 2016, Trump was most prominently talking about tariffs to save American auto industry jobs and save auto factories in America. And those are the first tariffs or that sector that he relaxed within hours of imposing them, because I think someone pointed out to him that the supply chain for automobile manufacturing and parts is more complicated and it's not so simple. I still wonder if, an old word comes back to me, James, you'll remember from the 70s. We were going to fight inflation by jawboning. Remember jawboning? Mm-hmm. And that meant we'll talk about it a lot and shame people into lowering the price of eggs. I don't know. But I do wonder sometimes, and I think Charlie put his finger on it right here just now, how much Trump really believes in tariffs and how much this is Trump's typical supercharged, exaggerated rhetoric in service of trying to be, jawboning on steroids. All presidents of going back, Reagan put up with some tariffs under political circumstances that were difficult. He kind of had to. But, Bush put on tariffs to protect steel. So did Biden with their aluminum tariffs. We've had tariffs on Canadian softwood lumber on and off over the years. I don't keep up with it. But so I don't know. I'd like to think that in my optimistic moments that Trump is got a serious game here and he's playing it the way he does everything else. And maybe it will get some results. But at some point, people are going to figure this out, as we have suggested before.
Well, those are individual tariffs. I mean, they're targeted specific tariffs. We've been doing that stuff, this sort of broad brush stuff. If it was just talk, that'd be one thing, but he did them. So that's another. And if he backs off from this, because I'm wondering what would make him back off from it, if anything, because everything, the wins that you've had, all of the rhetorical, philosophical, symbolic wins that Doge has been racking up by saying, look, America, you there, you guy, you who paid $5,000 in taxes last year, actually what we did is that your entire tax payment for the last 20 years has been going to one alpaca farmer in Peru. I mean, and again, we no longer need to make up absurd examples of spending like this, because that's what it was. I think it was $90,000 for an alpaca farming in Peru. So somebody looks at that and says, well, exactly how does that supposed to work for me then? I am driving around on roads that are potholed. There's miscreants and lolling about in my park that isn't clean, etc. I mean, we know these are all complex state, local issues, but people just basically get the idea. I'm paying a lot of money for taxes, and if we lived in an absolute utopian clean paradise like Tomorrowland in the movie, throw a couple of nickels at the guy in Peru. But we don't. And why? So that's a win, because I think that then is nonpartisan. I think people, especially the middle, get that. But when all of a sudden you have shuddering economic contraction because of something that was put on that nobody really, really, really was voting for, I wonder at what point Trump looks at this and says, I'm going to cut my losses and back off of this. I don't know if he has it in him or if he's just going to be bullheaded about it and keep going forward. Charles?
I think he definitely has it in him because he keeps rescinding them when the stock market goes down.
Yeah.
Look, this is a real risk. So let's look at this both from the perspective of somebody who might hate Trump and from the perspective of somebody who really likes Trump. I think the argument against this course of action is applicable from both sides. If you hate Trump, you look at this and you say, well, he's doing tariffs, they're stupid, he's a stupid person and he's being stupid and I hate him. Okay, fine. If you like him, you don't want this problem, and it's become a problem, to overshadow all of the other things that you want him to do, because the maxim that it's the economy stupid is still true. It's the primary reason that he won the election. He won the election because Joe Biden and his party made inflation a great deal worse in 2021 by pumping a whole bunch of money into the economy that the economy did not need and creating the worst inflationary environment in 40 years, and then saying it's not happening, and then saying it's transitory, and then saying, well, maybe it is happening, but it's not too bad. And then, and this is the worst part of all, passing a bill called the Inflation Reduction Act that had literally nothing to do with inflation. Well, look at Trump's policies right now, many of which I like, but look at what he wants to do in the next 6 months. He wants to expand the tax cuts from 2017, including taxes on tips, no taxes on overtime, no taxes on Social Security benefits. Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, said 2 days ago that their aim is to bring interest rates down, and he's imposed tariffs, supposedly at 25% on everything from Canada and Mexico. At least that's the aim. All of those things are inflationary, and inflation hasn't gone. People won't put up with it. Most people aren't ideological like we are. Most people don't follow politics like we do. They're going to say, wait, everything's expensive. I don't want things to be expensive. And when that happens, you don't get to do all of the rest of the stuff that I like. the reform of the executive branch and the destruction of DEI and some of the foreign policy, not all of it. But I think this is a real risk for him that he is taking, and not just, again, from the perspective of people who don't like him, who are going to say that anyway, but for the people who do like him.
Agreed. Although we can have this argument about taxing Social Security another day, perhaps. But I agree with you. And if inflation doesn't go down, then people are going to scratch their heads and wonder why. Now, you know, inflation is one of those things where, you know, it's hard to find a sweet spot for it, but your metabolism is different. Your metabolism, if your metabolism is working properly, you will feel that benefit in every aspect of your life. Now, I found a valuable tool that helps give me insights to create a healthy metabolism for my body, and it is called Lumen. Lumen is the world's first handheld metabolic coach. It's a device, right? It's a beautiful device, too. And it measures your metabolism through your breath. And on the app, it lets you know if you're burning fat or carbs, and it gives you tailored guidance to improve your nutrition, your workouts, your sleep, and even stress management. It's pretty cool. You blow into it, you watch the app, you send it the little ball, and you figure out what's going on. All you got to do is breathe into the Lumen first thing in the morning, and you'll know what's going on with your metabolism, whether you're burning mostly fats or carbs. And then what do you get? Well, a personalized nutrition plan for that day based on your measurements. And I love it because I love carbs, but I don't have a lot of them. And I like to know exactly what I get. This says you can have X many carbs. Whoa, great. Find me a croissant. You can also breathe into it before and after workouts and meals so you know exactly what's going into your body real time. And Lumen will give you tips to keep you on top of your health game as well. Like I say, not only do I love this thing, I just love the look of it, the sleek feel of it. It's a good piece of machinery. And I love getting that little program every day that tells me what I can have, what I should have. And it's just helped me keep my weight exactly where I want. So take the next step to improving your health and go to lumen.me/ricochet to get 20% off your Lumen. That's lumen.me/ricochet for 20% off your purchase. You'll love this thing. And thank you, Lumen, for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast.
Looking to give your business a competitive edge?
Absolutely. How can I make that happen?
Check out AskROI.com. With over 200 AI agents, it will boost productivity and revolutionize your workflows.
Wow, that sounds impressive.
As a business owner, I can tell you it's a game changer. You'll see.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Now we welcome to the podcast Gerard Baker, the editor-at-large of the Wall Street Journal, and you'll also find his weekly Free Expressions column every Tuesday. There he hosts a podcast with the same name, along with the interview series WSJ at Large with Jerry Baker on Fox Business. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. It might be my first time, or it's my first time for a while anyway. I think we've done this before, but back in the ancient days of the perhaps the Biden administration.
That would be a long time. You know, we've been doing this forever. This is podcast number 7,742. So, you know, we may have had you back in the 2000s or something like that. So here we are. You know, we're halfway through the 100 days, and you get a little tired of the 100 days thing, but it's hard to shake, I guess. It's inevitable. Trump has packed more into the first half of the 100 days, I think, than I can imagine. It's this baffling welter. It's like standing in front, behind a jet engine into which somebody has fed feathers and tacks, and it's so what's your impression so far?
Yeah, it's the everything everywhere all at once to approach to governing. And by the way, there's obviously method in that, right? That's done very deliberately. I remember reading an interview with Steve Bannon years ago, I think in the early days of the first Trump administration, where he said, you know, part of the purpose of this is to project an image of activity and momentum and all of that, but also frankly, just to sort of overwhelm the media and political opponents. I mean, you know, you one minute you're talking about Matt Gaetz being nominated for something, and everybody's throwing their arms up about that, and then the next thing we're talking about Tulsi Gabbard, and so we've forgotten about Matt Gaetz. You know, so you know, there's no question it's a, you know, and again, everything from executive orders on everything from, you know, immigration to you know, the administrative state to tariffs and goodness knows what else. I mean, so you don't have time. The media don't have time to digest and interpret and critique and do all of those things that you would normally do. So part of it is, you can only stand back and look at that and say, wow, that's kind of impressive management as well as impressive sort of energy. I do think maybe this was the week in which, you know, maybe we saw some of the kind of downsides of the frenetic pace. First of all, the tariffs, right? I mean, they're just a disaster. Let's be completely honest about it. They're not only a disaster in themselves intrinsically. I'm a firm believer the tariffs generally do nothing but harm. But the back and forth and the desultory way in which Trump is, you know, yes, they're on one day, they're not the next, and you can see the reaction in the financial markets. Nobody likes that, and so that's, you know, that's maybe a sign of this extraordinary this train hitting the buffers. You've had the I think more worrying signs about the economy. Jobs numbers weren't too bad today, but I think that's also going to kind of punch some holes in this performance. And of course, you know, losing the case at the Supreme Court, or at least sort of temporarily, as I understand it, losing the case at the Supreme Court on the on again another administrative state case. So it feels a little bit as though, and then by the way, you know, the European I'm in Europe at the moment, and this extraordinary revolutionary kind of temper that there is in US European relations, I think that is also perhaps a sign that things are not going quite as smoothly as planned. So look, I think there's, it's been a highly productive, incredibly productive start from the executive side. We've got to see, obviously, where any of the legislative process goes. That's there's especially the big beautiful bill and other stuff. But I just think we're starting to see, for the first time this week, I wouldn't say go as far as to say the wheels coming off, but this. When you start out with this kind of blizzard, then stuff is going to start to fall by the wayside, and I think we're starting to see that.
Jerry, it's Steve Hayward out in California.
Hello, Steve.
And so, by the way, my Tuesday morning starts reading your column in the Journal. Actually, my mornings start with reading all the daily columnists, and I wish you could get Dan Henninger to unretire and come back on Thursdays. But anyway, I ask you about the European scene since you're over there. I've been playing out the theme lately with people that, just as Trump is attempting to overthrow the Wilsonian legacy, Woodrow Wilson's legacy of the administrative state at home, he is also trying to undo the Wilsonian legacy in foreign policy. In other words, the Wilsonian internationalism that has been the consensus view of both parties, at least since the end of World War II, if not in certain ways before all that. And I think I'm sympathetic to that project in some ways, that it'd take a long time to go through. But I don't think there's any way that could be accomplished without some kind of big bang, without something that would be wrenching. I thought I was writing actually when Obama was president, that he had the opportunity, if he wanted to reset sort of American-European relations and the NATO strategy and so forth. But he really had no interest in that. And so, of course, Trump's going to be bumbling. But I think there is potentially an upside here. Am I too optimistic? What am I missing? Are Europeans so thoroughly alarmed and panicky that this was an ill-advised idea?
I'm here in Europe, wading through the broken eggs of the omelet that President Trump is in the process of making. I don't disagree with you there, James. Fundamentally, one of the things that I found really interesting this week, and it got a lot of attention, it got a lot of negative attention, when Trump gave, I think he was in the Oval Office and he was talking, doing that strange thing that he does where he kind of holds a kind of a rolling impromptu press conference while he's signing those executive orders. And he was talking on a topic, he got onto the subject of Japan and the Japan security pact that the US has with Japan. And he said, it's kind of ridiculous. We have a pact with Japan whereby we promise to protect them if they get attacked, but what do they do for us? Absolutely nothing. They don't do anything for us. Who the hell came up with that idea? The answer obviously is Douglas MacArthur, and it was an essential part of the post-war settlement, that actually the pacification of Japan was considered back then to be a rather important national security priority for the United States. But it did strike me then, just, and this is your point about, back to your point about Europe and the Wilsonian framework, it struck me then that he has a point. Because the answer, as I just said, to who came up with that crazy idea was, Douglas MacArthur and then Truman and then ultimately Eisenhower. And it was a good idea at the time, right? But that time was 70 plus years ago. It probably doesn't make any sense. We don't view Germany and Japan today in the way that we did in, 1945, 1946. So, of course, we need a new order. And I think more broadly, the kind of, if you call it Wilsonian, but the sort of, the post Cold War liberal order that was, very much the thing for a long time. I also agree with that. The US has different strategic interests. The world poses a different set of challenges. And I think I absolutely think there's a lot to be said to it. The only thing I'll say, though, is, I think Trump has incredibly good instincts, and sometimes his instincts put him, a really, really good political and even geopolitical instincts, and they put him in a place where, perhaps almost inadvertently, he discovers this is exactly the right strategic approach that we should be taking. But then he does also, frankly, and, you know, this is also the question at the back of everybody's mind, is he really kind of unconsciously undoing the Wilsonian order, unconsciously undoing the global liberal order? Or does he just have a bit of a thing for Vladimir Putin? You know, and I'm not being too flippant about that, and I certainly don't buy the, you know, Putin's got something on him compromat kind of thing. But it just does seem in his case, he just really has a thing for the man and never says a bad word about him. I'm conscious that he, you know, just actually has called it and said that he imposed sanctions this afternoon. So you know what? It's all I'm saying is we do this with Trump all the time. Like, he's this incredible. Charles wrote a terrific piece recently about the, you know, unpicking the absurd observation claim that Trump plays 4D chess. You know, everything he does is like, oh, whoa. You know, so I think, well, I can't remember, it was Talleyrand said of Metternich, or the other way around, when they died, you know, I wonder what he meant by that. And that's what we tend to do that with Trump. We do that with Trump, right? I mean, it's like, you know, he just sent out a text tweet saying kafifi. That's incredibly sophisticated observation on the state of the world. No, that's the problem with him. I mean, you know, his instincts are good often. Sometimes they're not. They're terrible. But is it instinct or is it, you know, grand strategy?
I mean, that's a good question. There is a headline, a news headline in your paper today. I haven't read the story, but the headline, it goes something like, Germany considers acquiring nuclear weapons. And I wonder, is this for real or is this the Germans learning how to play Trump's game?
I have a very dear friend, a Jewish journalist friend and colleague who, you know, when we were having these arguments years back about burden sharing and whether the Germans should be doing more and that the Germans were, you know, useless militarily. And he would say, and we'd have this argument, he'd say to me, he'd say, Jerry, he said, we are having an argument about how bad it is, about whether or not about the fact that the Germans aren't, you know, militaristic enough. That is a good thing, you know. That is something anybody in the last 200 years would be celebrating. Why on earth are we kind of, you know, worrying about it? So when you see a headline saying the Germans want to get nuclear weapons, you know, on one level you might think, uh-oh. But one of the things I wrote quite recently, I wrote a column sort of just looking at kind of the implications of this new world order, and nuclear proliferation is absolutely one of them. I mean, that's, you know, if I am Germany, for that matter, and you know, Friedrich Merz, the soon-to-be chancellor, has said this, but if I'm Poland, if I'm the Baltics, and if I think NATO is in effect a dead letter, which I think, frankly, if it isn't now, it will be soon, the first thing I want is to get my hands on a nuclear weapon, because I want to be able to say to Vladimir Putin or whoever his successors are, you know, you come after our cities, we're gonna annihilate Moscow. So this is the reality. But I think, I do think, James, the larger point here is that I do think NATO, even if it's not formally dead, and, you know, I think Trump will probably come back and say some nice things about it, or be persuaded to say some nice things. I saw Pete Hegseth yesterday saying some very nice things to the British defense minister. But I think in practical terms, do you think, for example, that Donald Trump would take America to war to defend Estonia if Vladimir Putin invades tomorrow? I don't. I mean, I just don't.
Hi, Jerry. It's Charles Cook here.
Hello, Charles.
On the question of 4, 5, 6, or maybe 7D chess, what is your take on Trump's attitude toward tariffs? Because it's certainly been a feature of his rhetoric for years, since the 80s. But it is totally incoherent. And he does seem to impose them and then back off. You can't reconcile the way he talks about tariffs as being the greatest thing that have ever existed with his conduct and his incorporation of them into this art of the deal myth. So what do you think he's doing? Because it is inscrutable to me. It looks chaotic.
Yeah. It does look chaotic. I agree. Look, I think he has a very, dare I say, simplistic, but sort of simple view of international economic relations, not even mercantilist. It's just a very simplistic arithmetical view, which is that if one country has a trade surplus or current account surplus with the United States, then it's cheating. It's just cheating. We're being ripped off. I mean, he keeps using phrases like subsidize. He says, you know, when he talks about the US having a trade deficit with Canada, he says Americans are subsidizing Canada, which of course is economically nonsense. It's not a subsidy; it's an economic transaction. But you know, we get oil, and the Canadians get US dollars, and they're very happy. And both sides used to be very happy with that arrangement. So, but I think he thinks of the international economic system, that it is a kind of zero-sum game, and you know, just probably just as he, you know, when he was a real estate guy, if he was winning, if he beat somebody to a deal, that meant he was winning and the other guy was losing. And so I think it stems from that basic view that the world is unfair, and that what you need to do then to redress that unfairness, to redress that injustice, is tariffs. Tariffs are, you know, are obviously an obvious way to do it. They, you know, they hurt us, but they hurt the other side more, because they will have the effects, other things being equal, of reducing the other side's exports. So I think it's that simple. And then I think he's built on top of that this idea that tariffs will generate huge amounts of revenue. He keeps talking about, you know, William McKinley and how, you know, tariffs generated the vast bulk of federal income back then. And that's when the federal government represented about 2% of GDP. But you know, so I think from that basic sort of economic equation, kind of false economic, if you like, economic equation, that if your trading partner has a surplus, then they're cheating and they need to be hauled in. He then builds on these other ideas like tariffs will produce great revenue, and he's not wrong about the, you know, that tariffs ultimately will induce and incentivize American or indeed any company to come and, you know, build in the United States. So, but I think it really stems from that. I think Charles and I remember, you know, looking where I remember I lived in New York in the 1980s, late 80s, and I remember him taking out those ads in the New York Times when he would say, you know, when the trade deficit with Japan, and they would have an enormous trade deficit, and he'd say, look, this is wrong, they're cheating, this is absolutely outrageous. And I really do think it comes from that.
Yeah, his rhetoric's the same. He used to say politicians in America are feckless and they're allowing Japan to cheat. It's pretty much a through line from that. My second question is about the budget. Republicans historically have talked about the deficits we run every year. They've talked about the debt that those deficits create. They've talked about the issues that we have with entitlements. And Trump doesn't. Now, you can make the argument that this is politically smart, because it is. People don't want to hear it. The public is not there. Republicans who talk in that way lose. But the math remains the same. Do you expect Congress to just blow open the deficit this summer when they pass their spending and tax bills, or do you think any saner voices will prevail?
No, I think they'll go for broke, and I think with one caveat, which I'll come to. I think if the economy is slowing, as it really does seem to be doing, I think, you know, we're getting these sort of the usual kind of hail of not necessarily consistent data, but it usually points broadly in one direction. Even today's jobs numbers were, you know, on the softer side, and we've seen 2 months of relatively soft employment growth. The certainly the markets think the economy is slowing very sharply. That's why, you know, market interest rate, treasury yields have fallen. And I think there's a pretty good chance that we get to the middle of the year, or as this budget and tax cut goes through Congress, I think the nervousness about the economy will grow, and I suspect that will, you know, that will be enough to silence the whatever remaining deficit hawks there may be. Right. Because, you know, the argument is going to be we really need a stimulus. But the caveat I was going to say is, at the same time, inflation is certainly not going away. It's getting worse. I don't think, as it happens, for, you know, reasons we don't need to go into, I don't think tariffs are inherently inflationary. I think they lead to a one-time increase in the price level, and they're not necessarily recurring, which would only be inflationary. But they will raise, if we ever actually impose these tariffs, we keep going through this sort of, you know, hide and seek with tariffs that we've been doing for the last couple of months. But if we ever get the tariffs, then they will push up prices. And, you know, and a big fiscal blowout, even though it might be advantageous for demand in the economy, if demand is really weakening, could also, you know, will certainly make the inflation picture worse too. So you could, you know, this is the stagflation scenario, obviously. The other caveat or conditional is if we, you know, if the market really, if we have a market event where it looks like the market suddenly takes fright, bond yields spike, and people think this is not sustainable at 125% of GDP debt level, and that causes a real rethink. But I think that's low probability outcome. I'd say they push it through.
Looking to give your business a competitive edge?
Absolutely. How can I make that happen?
Check out AskROI.com. With over 200 AI agents, it will boost productivity and revolutionize your workflows.
Wow, that sounds impressive.
As a business owner, I can tell you it's a game changer. You'll see.
Jerry, it's Steve Hayward again. I want to ask you a question about your column this week about the consequences of collapsing public trust in the media. And what I want to do for listeners is just quote two sentences from it to get the flavor of it, and then I'll give you my question about it. Here's what you write. What happened is that news organizations were transformed in character and purpose. They went from being quasi-legal institutions to quasi-religious ones. They are more like prayer books for a believing congregation. Their purpose is to strengthen believers' faith by offering reassurance and imparting moral guidance. And you have even more harsh things to say after that. I agree with all of that. I do wonder if the problem of the collapsing public trust in the media goes deeper and shares something in common with a parallel collapse in public trust with the universities and education. And I'll put this proposition to you. I think it was a great turning point or a mistake that decades ago, journalism went from being a working class profession, like being a policeman or something like that, to a skilled profession with people getting journalism degrees from Columbia and so forth. And so beyond the problem of having people who are very progressive go into newsrooms, and you point that out in a sequel paragraph, is that people, I think, who are actually not that well-educated. And here's my bold proposition. I think you go back 7 or 8 years ago to a daily newspaper reporter who had only a high school education, probably had a better grasp of history and American civics than a lot of our professionally trained journalists do today. And I think that's as much of part of the problem as ideology is. Is that completely outrageous to say?
No, it's 100% correct. And in fact, there's a chapter in my book, Steve, which I will encourage your listeners to, American Breakdown, where how trust has collapsed. A whole chapter in my book in which I absolutely go through the kind of demography of the news business. And you're absolutely right. Now, let me tell you just one fun story, which I think I refer to in the book, actually. But when I was editor of the journal, a friend at a magazine, actually a news magazine, a conservative leaning magazine, recommended a bright young reporter to me, and he said, "You'll love him." He said he's looking for a job and he wants to work for, he'd love to work for the journal, and you know, to talk to him. And he said, "I'll give you this is an example of why you'll like him." He said, "He's only 3 or 4 years out of some Ivy League college. Very bright, but a very good reporter, very, very thoughtful, very fair, very analytical and scrupulous." And but they sat him down, and when he said he wanted to be a reporter at the Wall Street Journal or somewhere else, they said, "Well, you know what? Why do you know you're bright, you're smart, you've got great prospects, you're working for a magazine, you could be a commentator, a columnist, an opinion writer." And this young man apparently said, "I'm 26 years old. I've been out of college for 4 years. Who gives a shit what I think of anything?" And I just thought that's absolutely the kind of reporters we need, and that is exactly it. I mean, there's they you're absolutely right, Steve. You know, they come out of university and they've been, you know, expensively educated, and they have imbibed all that, you know, nonsense, unfortunately, that's taught at most of these universities, and they come out with a, you know, what they come out with that sort of Marxian approach. What did Karl Marx say? The philosophers sought to interpret the world. The point is to change it. And that sort of, I think that's, you know, that's how I view journalists. You know, journalists used to just go out and report the world exactly as you say, because they didn't have sort of highfalutin ideas about, the way the world should run. They just wanted to go out and find out what was going on. And instead, they've been replaced by this cast of, self-revering intellectuals who want to tell people how to think, and I couldn't agree more.
The average newspaper of, say, the 1940s, 1950s or so would have probably 20-30 stories on a page. Now, they might be car accidents or the fact that a toddler had slipped on a roller skate and hit his head, but you got this great big panoply of life in these papers. And now, of course, you'll find maybe one or two stories on the paper, if the paper even exists anymore. And it will be something of a deep social importance or something that is happening around town that is seen through a particular prism that oftentimes is just not available. The people who are holding that prism in their heads don't know that they have that prism. They still think they're being objective. But I want to ask you this.
But I was going to say, but sorry, James, if I may interrupt just quickly. It would be toddler slips on ice, white supremacy to blame. Or,
right, right.
colonialism to blame.
Right, right. Because one of the things that has been, I'm sitting in a newspaper office right now. I've been in a newspaper since 1978. And as an opinion writer, because you know, what the hell do I know? And one of the things that's bothered me the most in the last few years is this shift away from even paying obeisant lip service to objectivity, because objectivity means giving credence to evil, is what a new generation of journalists say. When you poll them in these J schools, which ought not to exist in the first place, they tell you, well, you know, there's no other hand when it comes to Hitler. There's no other hand when it comes to climate change. So let's go to the Washington Post and look at that paper and the competition. Bezos is trying to do, apparently, he lockstep with Goering and Goebbels and the rest of it. He's demanding, or perhaps requesting, that the editorial page come out for free economy and personal liberty. Which again, fascist adjacent issues right there. That and the reaction of the staff seems to tell me that probably is indicative of their own blinders and their own ideology, which will continue to doom the news industry as we know it today. Right.
No, exactly. I mean, yeah, the idea that, again, but you absolutely, you know, identify the ideological issue, but just the kind of larger, to me, and this is such and so typical of the sort of entitled view that we have to deal with so many, you know, the idea that someone pays, you know, essentially pays someone's salary and loses hundreds of millions of dollars over a 15-year period to keep this thing afloat and keep these people employed. The idea that it's absolutely outrageous that person, that owner, should then actually decide he thinks he would like the paper's opinions to broadly align with his own. No, this is the problem we have. But it's one of the reasons, again, I said this, sorry to revert to my own column, but you know why people don't trust them anymore. It's they've lost all credibility and not only credibility, but also they've lost any sensibility too. You know what I mean? I think they move in such rarefied circles. They all believe that, you know, Donald Trump is the second coming of Hitler and you know, all that stuff that they've been taught about colonialism and all that kind of thing. They don't meet anybody who even disagrees with that. I mean, I always remember a story someone telling me, you know, some time ago. They were out for, you know, dinner with a bunch of journalists back in the 2016 campaign, and you know, somebody said, "Well, how many people around the table voted for Trump?" Or just after the campaign was in, and not a single hand went up. And then the more interesting question was, "How many of you know anyone who voted for Trump?" Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. still not a single hand went up. And that's, you know, again, I don't want to be too harsh. There's a lot of still terrific journalists out there doing honest work, good work. But it has, you know, I hesitate to use the word profession because I don't think it is a profession, but as an occupation and as a useful function for society, it's lost its way incredibly badly. And I, you know, don't think it's over. I think there are ways in which it can be recovered, but it's in a very, very, very bad place.
I regret it too. I love it because I love this industry. When I go to England, I stay with a Telegraph family, and there's just something about opening up that big paper. And I love the Telegraph. That reminds me what the medium can be. But when Stephen was talking before about the lack of faith in journalism and the lack of faith in the institutions of education, doesn't it? It's part and parcel of a broad spectrum lack of faith in the institutions. There's been a suicide of institutions, institutional credibility in the last 4 or 5 years that seems to be nearly every single one of them that you can think of, possibly with the exception of the American military, which again, you know, was doing things like, well, we got to, you know, we have to pay for the surgeries of transgender soldiers, or we simply won't be the effective fighting force we want to be. Which institutions have survived the last 5 years or so and actually gained credibility with the people, or is it just pretty much everything that we look at seems to have revealed itself as made of fallible human clay and you know, bent timber?
I apologize profusely because I did not come on this show, which I love this show. I think it's terrific, and I'm honored to do it. But I did not come on the show to promote my book, but this again is where I actually go through this in the book. And actually, if you look at the data, the institutions that there are a few institutions that have in which trust continues to be relatively high. The military, you mentioned, although as you say, there's been some damage to that over the last few years. But the really interesting ones are small businesses. Actually, people still really have a very, very high level of trust in small business. Oddly enough, they also have a high level. Well, I shouldn't say oddly enough; that's unfair. But certainly counter to the kind of broader trends, they have got a high level of trust in local government too. They, you know, again, when local government works for them, I mean, you know, if the DMV is efficient, you know, which in many places it is. Actually, I live in New York City, and to my intense surprise, New York City government is a disaster on every front. The only two things the New York City government does remotely efficiently is the DMV for some reason, and of course tax collection. It's brilliant. It's incredibly efficient at both of those. But you know, so people do. So if their streets are cleaned and they can get their driver's license and they can the police are pretty good and the fire the people that they like the firehouse. So people have high levels of trust. And I think the larger point here, and I did draw this conclusion in the book, is that the closer people are, part of the problem, I think it's only a part of it. I wouldn't in any way claim that it's hugely important, but I think part of the problem has been that institutions have become larger and more remote, and we've become more remote. And this is a function, again, inevitably of the digital age, that, you know, we just do spend so much, you know, we can do so much, you know, without stepping outside of our front door, that I think that has created a kind of, you know, forgive me for using this term, but sort of an alienation and a kind of isolation, which breeds mistrust. But so when people actually encounter and have interactions with institutions, direct institutions, small businesses, where they go into the mom and pop store, or they go into the, you know, into the local restaurant, whatever, and they get a good meal, they like them. They have, and again, this is reflected in data. You can look it up. They have a high level of trust in small business. They have quite a high level of trust in, you know, very, very local government. They even have quite a high level of trust in local newspapers, which tells you something. So I think there's something there about the kind of bigness, that bigness and remoteness has bred mistrust, as well as all these other things that we've talked about.
So we don't want to be bigly. I get it. And you're right. Local is better. Let's just record scratch up in the just sketch. And I want to get back to England. One of the things that people who are very online here in America are aware of is that there seems to be two things going wrong with England. One of them is immigration, which is reshaping the nation in ways that people perhaps don't like. And the other is a crackdown on free speech, in which it seems as if you can stab somebody for setting a Quran afire. But if you have a thought in your head outside of an abortion clinic, or if you post something critical of a local councilman on your Facebook page, then the police will come around and place you under caution and talk and wave badges at you. Are we exaggerating what's going on there, or are there, let's just do the free speech thing, is there a worrisome trend or an old trend worrisomely exacerbated in England when it comes to the free expression of ideas in England of all places?
The answer is yes and yes. I mean, there is some exaggeration. I mean, you know, to read some people over here, and indeed to listen to J.D. Vance when he went to Munich and talked about this a few weeks ago, you'd think that Britain was essentially East Germany in, you know, circa 1967 or something, and, you know, that people are being arrested all the time for saying, you know, politically unacceptable things. It's obviously not true. You can still go and go online, and anybody spends any time online in England knows that there is a, you know, just a deluge of free speech. There are still, you know, newspapers and television, and in fact there are more television channels than there ever were when Charles and I you know, grew up there. So it's, of course, it's exaggerated, but I won't diminish it. There is the absence of a First Amendment protection. The domination of the major institutions of government, law enforcement, and by government I mean sort of the permanent government, although now you can add to that the elected government, but this was going on when the Conservatives were in power too, and the dominance of the cultural institutions like universities and the media does mean that there's been a considerable amount of an attempt to police speech, and I think this fits in with another thing which I think is even more sinister, but it's related in the UK, which is there's been, by the way, Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, is an absolutely kind of first-rate exponent of this. Mm-hmm. There's been this attempt. Which we've had a little bit of in the United States, a lot of in the United States, but I think it's going further in the UK, to essentially transfer out of democratic political decision-making very important issues of social and cultural matters, indeed political matters, and have them reside in the legal, in the courts. So essentially to establish rights in the courts, which are then invulnerable to any sort of political, to any attempt by politicians, democratically elected politicians, to overturn them. That is something, you know, so that's why you get some of these cases, because there are, you know, it has been enshrined in law that hate speech, things like hate speech have been enshrined in law, or, you know, there's a big debate going on in Britain about whether or not ultimately it should have. It won't under the Labour government, but under the Conservatives, whether Britain should essentially derogate from the European Court of Human Rights, where all of these rights have been, on issues like, on religious expression or on abortion or many of these big hot button social issues, by the way, as obviously happened here, by the way, of course, with Roe v. Wade. To make them essentially invulnerable or sort of immune to the political process and to have the courts be the deciding authority. That is a very worrying thing, and it's allied to this not insignificant attempts to suppress certain types of speech.
Yeah. Well, as a former BBC producer yourself, I'm sure you know that the deep wellspring of right wing thought at the BBC will eventually come out. And
yes, he's sitting in an isolated chamber somewhere in Broadcasting House, and they don't let him out. But yes, on the occasion.
Did you know Paul Heine when you were there?
I did, actually. Yes, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I know Paul and Libby.
Oh, they're, yeah, no,
yes, I do. Know. They live in the town in Suffolk, where I go a couple of times a year, a little place called Walbers.
There were a few kind of, you know, dissenters from the BBC Progressive Orthodoxy, but I'm not joking here. I think they all left. I mean, I think every single one I knew who was, you know, vaguely kind of differed from the progressive nostrums, literally, you know, just couldn't stand it and left.
Oh, their bones were ground for cafeteria gruel, I'm sure of that.
Exactly.
Jerry, it's been a great pleasure, as ever, and we hope to have you back as soon as possible and talk about all the great things that are happening in the fantastic Renaissance of America, et cetera, et cetera. But in the meantime, advise everybody to read his books and read him in the Wall Street Journal. And thank you very much for being on the show today.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Cheerio.
You know, you get this sort of warm feeling when your guest talks about how much they enjoy the show. And it was interesting because I was checking his biography on Wikipedia just to catch up on a few details. And the inset picture of him, his picture on the Wikipedia page, is identical to the picture that we're looking at in our video feed. it was a bit unnerving, as a matter of fact, as though, oh, that's right, I do live in a simulation, a matrix, and it's just been updated for my own satisfaction and convenience here. I get it.
But he looked well-rested in both, didn't he, James?
Absolutely so. No, we don't live in the matrix. We are not, you know, hairless people shivering in a capsule of blue goo and having our electricity drained, which didn't make any sense technically. But sometimes you want to wrap yourself in something that's warm. And I imagine that, you know, if you popped out of the Matrix cube and were sort of all wet and confused, and you'd want somebody to drape a nice blanket or towel around you, wouldn't you? No, we're not living in the Matrix. We're not all a bunch of people in little pods there, you know, living in liquid. No, we're not. We are in the real world. But the real world can get cold, and the real world sometimes can get harsh, and that's why you need a little bit of luxury in your life. Luxury, it starts where you rest. Your bedroom, it should be more than just a place of sleep. It should be a retreat, right? Cozy Earth. Cozy Earth's best-selling bamboo sheets are buttery soft, temperature-regulating, and crafted for five-star comfort every night. Cozy Earth's goal is to help you turn your home into a sanctuary, a place where you can escape the outside world's demands and truly unwind. Life gets hectic, right? And finding comfort and calm, it's essential. Your time outside the 5 to 9 should be all about relaxation and recharging. There's that matrix again. And soaking in the sense of peace. With Cozy Earth, you can create a space that feels like a personal retreat where comfort, serenity come together naturally. I don't have my cozy earth sheets yet. I'm looking forward to them. But we are in the presence of a man who, shall we say, acquiesced to his spouse's wisdom on the matter. Is that right, Charles?
You remember the word that I used. I'm honored.
Oh, did I? Did you use acquiesce?
I did.
Did I automatically ascribe a multisyllabic word to our fellow of great breeding and education? So do go on.
I did. I acquiesced. I concurred. I submitted even. But I'm glad that I did.
Let's not go that far. We don't want to put that mental
picture. Oh, I'm glad that I did, especially when we're talking about sheets. I like them a great deal. My wife made a good choice. Cozy Earth sheets are fantastic. It's very important. I know I always say this, but it's very important to get sheets right in Florida because it's not just hot, but unlike in California, it's humid. And so you just have to get the right sheets. And these are the right sheets. And if they weren't the right sheets, then I wouldn't sleep in them. But they are, and I do.
There you go. You, too, can transform your space risk-free with a 100-night sleep trial. 100-nights sleep trial and a 10-year warranty on all the Cozy Earth beddings and bath products. Love them or send them back. But trust us, you won't want to. Luxury shouldn't be out of reach. Sanctuary awaits at Cozy Earth. Visit CozyEarth.com/ricochet and use our exclusive code RICOCHET for up to 40% off Cozy Earth's best-selling sheets, towels, pajamas, and more. That's CozyEarth.com/ricochet. And if you happen to get a post-purchase survey, would you mind telling them that you heard about Cozy Earth right here? Thanks. And we thank Cozy Earth for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, gentlemen, before we go out, I think we should all just, for a moment, have some fellow feeling and some empathy for those who are on their uppers. And that would be Hunter Biden, apparently, is broke. From what I read, I think he spent he sold like 24 paintings in a year for $50,000. A throw, and now miraculously, since the beginning of this year, the demand for his work doesn't seem to be as robust, and his book has only sold 1,100 copies in the last 6 months or so. So he's broke. Why is that? Why I'm trying to figure out, because the abiding quality of art should be such that Sotheby's should be just jacking up the price again and again and again and again, because we haven't seen a style and a talent like his in years. What is going on in this world when nobody's buying Hunter Biden's book? That's what I'm asking you.
Well, it just goes to show the cruelty of the artistic gods, doesn't it? That he was for a brief period, Hunter was touched by greatness, and he produced 27 works of art, all of which sold in a 2 or 3 year period that, in an amazing coincidence, overlapped with his father's tenure in the White House. And people thought they are the linchpin of my collection. And in the last 1 year, I hear, he sold just one. And I just think that is what happens to every great artist. After a while, they just sit there with the blank canvas and the brush dripping paint in their hand, and they think, why has my inspiration gone? This was what happened to the Beach Boys.
Very droll, Charles.
He would sit for hours with his feet in sand next to the piano, and he couldn't come up with another God only knows. And that seems to be Hunter's lot. So we should.
Look, this was the most predictable news story of the year. You can see this coming. Well, you can see this coming years ago. I think the next shoe to drop on this story will be, my suspicion from the beginning is that Hunter didn't do any of those paintings. He had someone do them for him, just as the book would have been ghostwritten too. And maybe someday an enterprising journalist will get onto that, but that'll be the final little cherry on top of this embarrassing, melting ice cream of a crazy family.
What I wish he'd done is actually go full Warhol and paint representational art. So you'd have Brillo, you'd have Does, Biz, Tide, Dreft. Name every one of his canvases after a laundry detergent, just to make it all the more blatant exactly what is going on here in the purchase of these things. And still nobody in the media really would have cocked an eyebrow at the fact that people were paying ridiculous amounts of money for this ridiculous amount of art. Well, that'll do. We've had a substantial and dense piece of work here, a noble, two English accents in one podcast really does bring the general intellectual tenor up, I think, by at least 30, 40 degrees or points or whatever the Dow is down. 600, 500? I don't know. You know, I've lived through a few corrections in my time, so you buckle up, you buy in the dips, and then you keep going. One last thing I forgot to mention. Have you guys been hearing a lot from the left about how Donald Trump is coming after Social Security? I'm hearing this a lot. I'm having my friends on the left who are warning me that I better print out PDFs of what I'm owed because they're coming after it. Mm. I'm not exactly sure those PDFs would hold up in court, but I researched this morning, and as far as I could tell, Donald Trump has steadfastly said that he will not cut Social Security, but he has talked about reducing the workforce by 10%, which would mean then that Social Security would be less responsive and you might have trouble getting your checks. Is that basically the pith of the gist?
Yes. So two things have happened here. One is that Democrats just cannot stop but say that Republicans are going after Social Security. They wake up in the morning and they say this. It's a form of political Tourette's. Even if Donald Trump literally says, I will never touch Social Security. I love it. I hug it at night on my cozy earth sheets. They say, oh my goodness, did you hear what he said? That he's going to cut Social Security. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that a lot of news outlets, I have noticed, have either deliberately or because they're lazy, run headlines and lead paragraphs that conflate Social Security with the Social Security Administration. Because I was a bit confused by this too. It said Donald Trump plans big cuts to Social Security. And then you click through and in paragraph 8, it says administration staff.
Yeah.
Which is just not the same thing at all.
No, it's not. So good. Well, that's a relief then, so I can retire on my pittance, and maybe my pittance won't be taxed by the institute, by the very government that held a gun to my head and demanded that I contribute to it. Lend the liberty. Anyway, we thank you for listening. We thank Lumen and Cozy Earth for sponsoring. Your life will be better if you avail yourself of the virtues of their products, and we encourage you to do so. We encourage you to give 5 stars to us wherever you possibly can in your podcast review system, and we encourage, we entreat, we beg. No, we offer the open arms of embracing welcome for you to come to the Ricochet and join. And you say, why would I do that? I can read it. I can listen to it. No, the member side is where the friendships grow, where the topics range all over the place. And we're posts that eventually you see on the main page surface are initially planted. And it's the same place you've been looking for in the internet ever since they plugged this thing in. I'm James Lilacs. It's been great. Stephen Hayward, Charles, we'll see you guys next week, and we'll see everybody in the comments at Ricochet 4.0. Bye.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.